ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Picture this. You're walking through a glorious green field. You brush your hands through the long, supple grasses as you walk, the fresh scent wafting up to your nose. Birds glide effortlessly through the blue sky above you, and in the distance, you can see fat cattle grazing peacefully. Now imagine the same field, but stretching out before you is nothing but black, burned landscape. There are no birds, no cattle. The only sound is the crunching underfoot of a once luscious pasture that's been turned to grey ash. It's a depressing image, and one many farmers are more familiar with than they would like. Hello, I'm Callie Buchanan. Coming back from bushfire or prolonged drought is hard work. Now there's even more reason to persist. There's research showing access to beautiful lush green spaces can help people deal with trauma by immersing the senses in nature, often with the help of a guide. It's called forest bathing, and it's becoming popular around the world, with scientists studying its health benefits and accredited courses for practitioners. It's growing in Australia too, as James Tugwell reports.
Every day on his morning walk, Phil Stubbs stands still for at least 10 minutes and listens to nothing. Since he started giving himself permission to move slower, he notices all sorts of things in the silence. He notices the thud of a grey kangaroo bouncing, the fairy wren darting across the path, or the common blue-tailed dragonfly zipping through the air that he says tastes like eucalyptus. The resident from Congo on the New South Wales far south coast is practicing forest therapy.
We need nature to feel whole and human.
Mr. Stubbs remembers working 50 hours per week and looking out from his desk in a Sydney office building and seeing hundreds of humans hunched over computers in little glass-windowed boxes.
A lot of people spend a lot of their lives on computers, and I don't think we as human beings are evolved to do it.
Searching for ways to escape technology and reconnect with nature led Mr. Stubbs to forest therapy. He is so convinced of the benefits of the practice, he became one of 62 certified Association of Nature and Forest Therapy guides in Australia. Mr. Stubbs took me on one of the tours he started running in the Yurrabadalla Botanic Gardens, an area burnt during the Black Summer bushfires. Pulling off the Prince's Highway and turning off the car's engine, you enter a little natural haven.
Soon I'll get you to close your eyes, but before I do it, what I'd like you to do is just have a really good look around you and just notice where we are today.
Normally when you go for a walk, you don't do that. Often you're going from A to B. And really, this is about really taking in the atmosphere of the forest.
Mr. Stubbs says forest bathing is like coming home to yourself.
I think when you slow down and you start using your senses, you stop worrying about all the things that you've got to do and stuff coming up in the past, and you're just in the present moment. It's almost like it's given me license to just stop and notice things and think, yeah, I'm going to spend some time here with this and just notice. Like stand on the beach and notice the sun come up and listen to the waves and close my eyes and just really enjoy it. A couple of days ago, I ran into our neighbour who'd been away for a while. And I hadn't seen him for a while, and he said, "Phil, you look healthy." And so he said, "Dude, what have you been doing?" And this is one of the key things that I've been doing.
He sees economic potential in forest therapy to help people heal, de-stress or reconnect with nature. Association of Nature and Forest Therapy Director Jackie Quang says forest therapy could be used at corporate events, for rehabilitation at nursing homes or as an ecotourism attraction.
There's great potential and we've probably only scratched the surface, but on the mental health front, there's a lot of potential there.
She says there is scientific research showing the practice reduces blood pressure and heart rate, increases brain oxygen levels, decreases production of the stress hormone cortisol, and leads to healthier sleep patterns.
Intuitively, we know that nature is good for us.
And there is growing interest in using the practice to help people reconnect with landscapes that have been ravaged by climate-related disasters. Phyllis Look has been leading therapy walks in the forests of Hawaii for 5 years. But her work took on a new purpose after Maui was devastated by wildfires last year.
There's like now this place in your homeland that has been, that you've always known was there, and now this place is no longer. Forest bathing is really good about establishing or reestablishing this connection to place and your connection to your identity, to who you are.
She is using forest therapy to help Hawaiian bushfire survivors and firefighters deal with their trauma. Before a recent session, one bushfire survivor told Miss Look she felt dead inside.
By the end of it, she said, nature has the answers. I may not know all the stuff that I need to right now, but nature has the answers. And she felt more alive again. She had like remembered that she wasn't just this dry husk of a person. So when you see that little green shoot that's coming out of the burnt tree, it tells you, hey, maybe that's also me. Maybe I too have a part of me that was destroyed, but that also there's a part of me that is emerging forth, and that it's not all dead and death and destruction. So I think that's one of the ways that we can think about how something that was dangerous can also eventually become a friend and helpful to us. Whether it's fires and floods, wars, pandemics, we need to be able to find a way to take care of ourselves.
Founder of Forest Bathing Hawaii, Phyllis Look, ending that story by James Tugwell. The work to create a beautiful natural environment starts well below the paddock. Right across northern Australia, cattle producers are digging deep into the world of soil crusts in an effort to improve their pasture and soil health. They're exploring the biocrust, the top crunchy layer of soil, particularly in arid environments, which is home to symbiotic microbes that assist plants to gain nutrients, resist temperature fluctuations, and prevent soil erosion. Since going below the surface, farmer Kathy Eggert has seen dramatic improvements in her soil, even during droughts.
We've increased our soil organic carbon content by 45% in 10 years, and we can take that further. But what that means to us particularly is our roots can grow deeper, our plants have access to more nutrients, and they can grow better, and the whole system just kicks on, and you know, things improve all by themselves. So the system's a lot more resilient to these extreme events. Like our soil, because of the broken down organic material in it, the humus in that soil, that buffers the pH of the soil. So that helps to make more nutrients available. And also what it does is it has what's known as a cation exchange capacity. It's a very high cation exchange capacity, so it enables those nutrients, really important plant growth nutrients, to be both available to the plants and stored in that topsoil. But a really key thing here is that having all that organic material in the soil stores moisture. So we, like during what we called a drought down in New South Wales, we were able to store 20% more soil moisture in our soil. And that made all the difference. Like that enabled us to grow plants. And then, you know, as the plants became a bit taller, like they were capable of actually catching any dew that came by. And, you know, that would trickle down to the root of the plant, and then the plant would grow better. It's just like the whole system is in a much healthier state and more capable of holding up to these extreme events that we've been experiencing, and we know that we're going to be experiencing more and more often, and the events will be more extreme.
What lessons do you think producers or land managers can take from your example, considering that there is, you know, very different amounts of rainfall and very different types of land?
Yeah, absolutely different. I think the grazing management is really important. You know, we need to not push our pastures and our soils too hard. But the key thing really is to improve the health of your soil, get those organisms happening in there, protect your soil crust and, allow the moisture to get into your soil and allow the nutrients to cycle in there. It's the building up the life in the soil. Regenerating the life in the soil is going to help the soil to be and the vegetation to be more resilient to climate change.
New South Wales farmer Kathy Eggert speaking with Victoria Ellis. Senior lecturer in regenerative agriculture and a farmer himself, Jeremy Bradley, says there's plenty of science to back up the results Kathy has seen at her place.
Grazing is a part of the maintenance of not only our economy, but of the soil itself. If you didn't graze the land and you didn't manage it at all that biocrust would just fry off in hot fires. And there's good research to say that cool burns are a way of enhancing the biocrust or maintaining the biocrust. Rotational grazing, somehow giving your paddocks a spell. Conservative grazing. Don't push too far into a drought before adjusting your stocking levels. Stocking conservatively is a good way to do it, and pull back your breeding herds into easily managed paddocks and spell everything else. It's giving the land that little bit of time to rest and recuperate.
Southern Cross University's Jeremy Bradley. In order to have lush green spaces, dry landscapes need to retain whatever moisture they can while they have it. Rain across northern Australia this summer has presented pastoralists with an opportunity to do just that, even in landscapes better known for their semi-arid climate. Around Tennant Creek in the Northern Territory, there's beautiful green regrowth, flooded plains and fat cattle. But graziers know all too well what could be lurking just around the corner.
Last year, huge bushfires ravaged the Barkly region for months. More than 2.8 million hectares were burnt, devastating and exhausting many cattle producers who lost cattle, pasture, infrastructure and time fighting the blazes. But now, instead of a red glow cast by massive walls of fire on sweaty, soot-darkened brows, many rural faces in the region are lit by an abundance of bright green grass shooting up from the previously blackened land.
Oh, it's just beautiful now. The buffalo grass around the house is 3 foot high. It's just very good. Yeah, best I've seen it for a long time.
Tennant Creek Station's Ken Ford said the property had received more than 1,000 mils of rain since January, after up to 40% of the land burned last year.
If we had to know we were going to get this much rain, we probably would let the rest of it burn, but it's good that the burnt country's come back really well.
Similarly, about 100 kilometres southeast, Amber Driver, manager of Elkidra and Anitawa stations, has had plenty of rain.
I think up to about 10 inches at Elkidra, which is not quite our annual rainfall, but we're very thankful to have that sort of rain, and it's been fairly consistent across both of the blocks. So it's definitely, given us a good start to the year. We're probably chasing a little bit more, but we're happy with what we've got so far.
Ms. Driver said the landscape looks amazing.
It's beautiful and green. We've got obviously different areas, different grasses, but the Spinifex is nice and tall and gone to seed. We've got a lot of the native grasses that are growing in between some of the other species and trees. Everything just looks amazing. A lot of flowers, bird life. The river hasn't run fully, but we've been able to capture a lot of side water, and a lot of the water holes are full, so we're pretty happy with that.
For both Mr. Ford and Ms. Driver, the conditions have made for some fat, healthy cattle. But the wet roads have delayed their first muster for the season. But there's another issue weighing more heavily on the minds of the cattle producers. How concerned are you for fire risks at the moment?
Yeah, look, we are very concerned. Given the fires that we had last year, we had a certain abnormal number of fires in the Northern Territory. That was right across the territory. A lot of those areas that burned last year has had significant amounts of rain. So, you know, historically in the desert, particularly if a fire went through, it was unlikely that we were going to have to go back there within, you know, a number of years. But we expect that this year that we'll be back in the same areas that we were in last year, given the amount of rain. We're hoping that a lot of people will start using this time now while the grass is still a little bit green and it's not fully cured, to use that time to reduce some of those fuel loads so that we don't have the wildfires later in the season.
Bushfires NT Chief Fire Control Officer Tony Fuller ending that report by Victoria Ellis. Preserving and managing natural landscapes isn't just about ensuring biodiversity or that the food supply can continue. When it comes to long-term brain health, living in a rural area might just have its advantages. Research out of Melbourne has found living in an area with green spaces and low crime reduces your risk of dementia. Angus Randall reports.
Quitting smoking, staying fit, and doing Sudoku, all ways to reduce your risk of dementia. Your dementia risk could also come down to how close you live to a park.
So to see that green space or living closer to green space was associated with having fewer dementia risk factors wasn't necessarily surprising.
Associate Professor Matthew Parzay is from the Turner Institute at Monash University. He studied more than 3,000 people across the country, looking at their local crime statistics and how walkable their suburb was. He found the further away you are from green spaces, the higher the risk of dementia.
People living closer to parks might find the time to go out and exercise more. They might find the time to go out and socialise, and being socially active is also protective against dementia. Also, the sort of appeal of green space might also have a sort of more calming effect on the brain.
There are many dementia risk factors connected to an unhealthy lifestyle. Smoking, heart disease and high blood pressure all increase your chances of dementia. Matthew Parzay can understand why those in areas with poor green spaces and a high crime risk may decide against an evening walk.
You know, we can have messaging around things that individuals should do to reduce their risk of dementia. But if an individual lives in an area where it's not particularly attractive to go out and exercise, or there might be high crime in that neighbourhood and they don't feel safe, I think governments need to consider, well, what things could they do, what policies could they implement to make it more likely for people to go out and actually take some ownership for their health and do the things we know are beneficial.
He acknowledges it's not as simple as moving to a nicer neighbourhood. The Monash study did not consider how people in wealthier suburbs likely have more education, more money and more time to take care of their health.
You know, we'd all like to live in affluent suburbs like Toorak, but obviously that's not within the reach of most people.
Last year, a study of nearly 62 million older Americans found green spaces could reduce the risk of dementia. The link appears to be clear. So what can we do about it? Eva Ritchie is from the Green Space Alliance in Western Australia.
It should be connecting spaces. So, you know, parks that go from one cul-de-sac through to another cul-de-sac, if you like. Somewhere that they connect through, you know, the little pathways that they can walk through safely. You're in a community, partaking with other people. It's like all of us. We're supposed to be connected. It's as simple as that.
She says in her experience, wealth remains a major barrier.
I come from Perth, love, and the western suburbs are all beautiful and green and lots of trees and larger blocks and all of that, you know. And then you go out into the outlying lower socioeconomic areas and we've got no water, you can't irrigate. Because, you know, it's, you know, 7 months no rain, you've got water restrictions and, you know, people are living inside their homes and not outside their homes. We are losing that connection to the outside, to the natural.
Research shows 40% of dementia is preventable and keeping the brain active plays a major role. Associate Professor Michael Woodward is an honorary medical advisor for Dementia Australia and head of dementia research at the University of Melbourne.
The main way to keep the brain active is to do half an hour of mental aerobics, if you like, every day. So it could be Sudokus, crosswords, chess, Scrabble, anything that gives you a bit of a mental workout. Their effect is not persistence. You've got to keep doing them all the time.
He says it's about more than working out your mind. A healthy body can also help fight off the risks of dementia.
It certainly seems to be that people know that if they keep mentally and physically active and eat a good diet, it's going to be helpful for their body in general. Their heart is probably the greater focus of attention, but the good news is generally what's good for our heart is also good for our brain.
Associate Professor Michael Woodward from the University of Melbourne ending that report. If you'd like to explore even further what it takes to put food on plates around the world, join me, Callie Buchanan, and our team of specialist reporters from across Queensland as we break down the big issues of rural life, from the food you eat to the clothes you wear and the home you live in. It's all available for you on the ABC Listen app. Just favourite the Queensland Country Hour or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening.